If you'd like to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 1 is where we'll be studying from initially this evening. Thank you so much for being here. Good to see the church family here together on Wednesday evening. As Terry's been making the announcements about silencing your devices, I couldn't help but remember at home, we have one fellow that is just very fervent, and that's not an overstatement, about people silencing their devices. And so one morning he's leading prayer. And it goes off. And everybody's just sitting there. We're trying to be very reverent as he tries to reach in the back of his pocket and turn it off. So when you tell people to turn off your device, you better make sure yours is off. We're concerned about our children. And we're concerned because we want to raise our children to be godly and have a fundamental respect for God. And as they move in their age to from adolescence to teenage years, there comes this struggle, this tug and this pull, this yin and this yang that happens between mother and child, father and child. And with the child wants the independence, but is not ready for the independence. And a large part of the struggles that go on with young people in that age bracket are because of that very thing. And we see in our world today, as we've noticed throughout the week, that influences throughout the world make it difficult and challenging for us, at the very least, to help our children have instilled in them a fundamental commitment to God. A fundamental commitment to God. And as I have said and reemphasize, we need the point of view that we're not trying to enforce, coerce our children to bow to us, as much as trying to create within them a will to bow to God. There's no doubt that learning to submit to the will of parents on earth will help them submit to the God of heaven. But submitting to the parents on earth is not our aim. The aim is to help them honor God. And if we look at our role as parents in that, from that particular point of view, through that paradigm, then I think it will help us as we face the challenges and the struggles that come with that tug and that pull with our children. I must tell you, I was a Johnny-come-lately to realizing that with my children, because I thought initially it was all about them obeying me. And when I realized that what I was trying to do was shape a heart that had a will for God, at least it made a difference for me. I also realized, and I just add this editorial remark, and then we'll move on, that it's easy to stand and talk about this. And it's easy to stand and talk about it after you're done doing it. And our parenting years, as far as the raising of the children is concerned, is over. Our children are grown. They have their own children, as I've said. And they are responsible for themselves now. I'm reminded at least once every year of that struggle all over again. And that's the week that we generally get to keep the grandkids. And by the end of the week, I understand why we had them when we were younger. Because at the end of the week, we're just absolutely worn out. But it is a good worn out. But it's challenging to deal with the interaction that takes place, fussing and fighting and then taking little ones to the potty because they're not quite able to go themselves and having to dress them. And the attention they require is just, it's just intense and it can be exhausting. And so I'm very sympathetic. I have a great deal of pathos in my heart and in my speaking when I'm talking to parents about this particular area of their role. I'm not unmindful of what you face on a day in and day out basis. And again, it's easy for me to stand up here and tell you what you ought to do. But I wasn't so good at doing what I'm telling you you ought to do. And we all are trying to adjust to that. But we're concerned about trying to help instill in our children a commitment to God. And I want to turn with you to 1 Samuel chapter 1. And I want to learn from Hannah and some things that she engaged in, the commitment that she demonstrated. When you come down to verse 6, it says, "And her rival provoked severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat." Well, why is Hannah so moved by that? If you put your marker there and turn to the 127th Psalm. Psalm 127, I'm sure a psalm that you're familiar with. But I think it speaks to something of the difficulty that Hannah is enduring. In Psalm chapter 127, beginning in verse 3. "Behold, children are heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of the warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has a quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." Here the psalmist reminds them and reminds us that children are considered a blessing. And the opposite was thought as well. If you don't have children, then it was considered a curse. Well, you come to the story of Hannah. At this period of time, you have polygamy that takes place, and the hardness of men's heart has set in, and God's marriage law has been violated for generations. And now then you have Hannah, whose husband has another wife, Peninnah, and Peninnah is able to bear children. But Hannah is barren. And with the information in the back of her mind that children are a blessing, she views herself as being cursed. Furthermore, Peninnah is rubbing it in her face to say, "Look at what I can do and you can't do. I can give Elkanah these children and you can give him nothing." And so Hannah has a problem. We come to verse 11. Verse 10 it says, "And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. Then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." Drop down to verse 15. Eli has now seen her pray. She's not praying out loud. Eli presumes, watching her pray, that she is drunk. I don't know what there was about her praying that would have led Eli to that conclusion. I've seen people pray, and I must tell you, I haven't seen them pray silently and walked away thinking, well, they were just drunk. But there's something about that that Eli presumes. It seems to me like Eli's got a speck in his eye, but he ain't got a log in his eye, and he's trying to take the speck out of hers. So she's clarifying what's going on, and so she is making this promise. But Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now." And then you have verse 17, "Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him." You then come to verses 21 through 23, and you have the commitment of Hannah. It says, "Now the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice in his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, Not until the child is weaned. then I will take him that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever. So Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. God gives her a son. She names him Samuel. And notice the commitment that Hannah makes with regard to Samuel. She has said in the promise that she's made concerning what she said to Eli, if he gives me this son, I will give him back. And she makes that commitment again to say, I will not go up until he has been weaned, and I will give him to the Lord. Only let him be the Lord's. I will give him to the Lord. When my son and his wife had their first child, I'd never thought about this, I must tell you. His father-in-law was in the room as we were all just doing and awing over Kaysen. And there was a moment of pause, and his father-in-law looked at him and said, you know who he belongs to, don't you? And my son said, yes, sir. Well, that's what Hannah is saying. I know who he belongs to. Lord, if you give him to me, I will give him back to you. That is the commitment that Hannah has made to the Lord. She has this problem. She makes a promise and she gives this commitment. If you give him to me, I will give him back to the Lord. I would suggest, mothers and fathers, that while these precious ones are our children, as the psalmist has said, they are a blessing from God. They've been put under our stewardship. He has given them to us that we might prepare them to be given back to him. He's given us those children to give back to him. And what we're trying to do in our role of stewardship as parents is prepare these children when they go out on their own to make a choice to bow to the will of the Father to be given to him. What a marvelous, marvelous statement that Hannah gives as a mother. And what a marvelous thing to think about as a parent. And yet what a weighty burden, what a weighty challenge that is on the shoulders of parents. There are several things I want to suggest to you that I think are important from the standpoint of commitment. I think we need to have, number one, a commitment to the Lord. That's quite obvious. What are we committed to? Let me ask. For what are you willing to leave your children? What are you willing to leave your children? Is it an inheritance that is wealth? Is it an inheritance that is some kind of possessions? What in your commitment to the Lord are you willing to leave your children? Are you willing to leave your children the commitment of your faith? We're passing the baton of faith to a new generation. Are you willing to leave them your faith? Are you committed to leaving them that? I reference again Eunice and Lois with Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 1. Paul commends the faith in his mother and grandmother. He says, which will also be in you. Where in part did Timothy get his faith? In part, Timothy got his faith at least in part from his mother and his grandmother. In other words, the legacy continues. What legacy are we willing to pass on to our children? Surely we're willing to pass something more than just, we're willing to pass something more than just our possessions. I reference again Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hold your finger there. And 1 Samuel, I'll put your marker there. Deuteronomy chapter 6, I think, flows into this. Notice what he says in verse 6 of Deuteronomy 6. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. How am I going to leave them that faith? How am I going to develop in them that capacity to believe that we talked about Sunday morning? I'm going to do that because I'm going to make common in my conversation. I'm going to make common in my conversation the Lord. I'm going to talk about His ways. I'm going to talk about His works. I'm going to talk about His greatness. If we leave our children nothing else, if in passing from this earth, there's nothing to take to the court to pass as a will to be adjudicated by the courts, but what we leave them is a strong fundamental faith that enables them to stand under the onslaughts of this world, that they are thoroughly grounded spiritually, we will have left them a significant inheritance and a significant legacy. The Lord will say in 2 Samuel, whenever Saul has been rejected as king, Samuel is going to look for another king and he goes to the house of Jesse. Here are the older brothers of David and they look like a king. Saul was tall, head and shoulders above everybody else. He looked like a king. But the Lord does not choose the older brothers of David. And then Samuel says, have you another son? And Jesse says, yes, we do. But he's out in the field watching the sheep. He's a ruddy young lad. What that meant was he's redheaded and he's a runt. He's the runt of the litter. In other words, there's nothing about him that you're going to find comely that's going to be appealing to you that is going to indicate to you he's going to be the king. But when Samuel sees him, God signifies to Samuel that David is going to be the king and anoints him then as king. Now he waits another 15 years or so before he sits on the throne. And the point I'm making about that is the very same point that the Lord makes there with Samuel. I don't judge men based on what everybody else sees. I don't look at men as everybody else looks at men. I look at the heart of men. And what I see is I see something in this young man's heart I don't see in the heart of everybody else. Oh, that we would stop in the hustle and bustle of our life and stop to think, what does God see? What does God see in this young person? The man who sculpted Lincoln, the story is said that there was a young boy that was watching him sculpt that great statue of Lincoln on the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. And as he was doing that, he said, what do you see in there? He said, I see a great man. The sculptor saw in that rock of marble a great man. I'm asking, what are we going to leave and what do we see? What do we see in our children? Do we see another Esther? Do we see another Ruth? Do we see another David? Do we see another Paul? Do we see another Timothy? I would suggest to you that deep within the heart of our children is potential that is unlimited. If what we will see is see them as God sees them, and what we see in them is the faith that we are handing off to them. We start with a commitment to the Lord. Second of all, I would say that we enhance that commitment by leading them with prayer. There were two men that wrote a book called Faithful Kids, Faithful Parents. And what they did was they talked to several children who were raised in homes whose parents were Christians. I'm sure that word is being used in the most accommodative way as far as the world would use it, not the New Testament, but for our purposes, we'll keep it illustrated. And they said, what was the significant thing in your life that led, that influenced you? And the answers came back something like this. One said, I saw my father praying and I heard him pray. Please help make me a better father. And I never forgot that. One said, I remember my father saying, please forgive me. He asked for forgiveness. Another said, I saw early in the morning my mother and father kneeling and praying and mentioning us, their children, by name. I heard them mentioning us by name. I've had that kind of experience. My dad's dad, my granddad, is one of the great heroes in my life. Died in September of 1974. But I'll tell you one of the two greatest memories I have of granddad is anytime we would go to visit Nanny and granddad, granddad would stop with all the family there, seven kids and all the grandkids that come with that, And he would stop in the evening and he would read the Bible sitting in his rocking chair. And when he was done, he would slide out of that rocking chair and get down on his knee. And the few times I was in the assembly with Granddad, as he was sitting on the front pew before he began to preach, the prayer was offered, he would quietly slide out of the pew on one knee and bow in prayer. I saw that great man praying. And Hannah here is praying. And what's she praying for? Eli misinterprets that. That's Eli's problem. But she is praying. She's praying for this son. And furthermore, she's not only praying for this son, she's going to make a robe for this son. And once a year, she's going to go down and she's going to see that son. And can't you imagine how filled her heart was with joy once a year when she would go down and see him and make that robe that she's freshly made and brought to him? We need to be praying for our children. Our children need to know that we're praying for them. And they need to hear us pray and see us pray. I think a third consideration is we need to release our child to God by faith. We need to release our child to God by faith. Here's what I mean by that. What we're doing as parents is trying to work ourselves out of a job. I'm fascinated, but the scripture says, and the man and the woman shall be husband and wife, and the two shall become one. That is never said about the parents and the children. It is never said, and the parents and the child shall become one. Why? Because God understood that children are being raised to leave their home. And parents, we must release them by faith to their own faith. And release them by faith to stand and make their own home. I think we make a mistake whenever we hold on too tightly, too long, and we don't want them to move too far away. One of the best things that ever happened to us was when we in 1981 moved to Del Rio, Texas and lived out there for 7 years. We were away from everybody. In fact, in the family counseling I do and pre-marriage stuff, I always advise young couples when they get married, the first move they're going to make is to Alaska. And get away from everybody. Because then they have only themselves to depend upon. We need to release our children and not hold them to it and then not give them a guilt trip because they left home to establish their own families. Zig Ziglar said with regard to a boat is made to leave the harbor and a boat that does not leave the harbor is good for nothing. Well, our children are made to leave home. Our children aren't made to stay under our roofs. Our children are made to establish their own families and having their own families develop their own faith with their own families and then fly away. I again refer to my great philosopher, Andy Griffith. The episode in which Opie has a slingshot and he's just shooting that slingshot randomly. And he shoots up in the trees and there's a nest with a mother and eggs that she's sitting on there waiting to hatch. And as Opie shoots his slingshot up into the tree, down comes the mother. He accidentally hit the mother and now she is dead. And Andy comes home and sees what has happened and said, did the cat get that bird? And Opie has to confess, no, Pa. I shot it with my slingshot. And Andy says, that mother had three eggs in that nest. And now there are going to be three little birds that are not going to have their mother. They take the nest down. Opie nurses them until they hatch and names them Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod. And he feeds them in that cage until the time comes in which now they've grown to the point where they're time to let them go. And Opie is just so touched by the fact. He said, Pa, will they know how to fly? He said, I don't know, son, but there comes a time in which they have to learn to spread their wings. And Opie throws the first one up in the air, and he spreads his wings and begins to fly, and then goes blinking and nod following winking. And that's true. There comes a time in which we must, by faith, release our children. Do you remember when you took your child to college and you drove off and you left them there? Do you remember when that U-Haul first pulled away from the house and now he has your daughter taking her to a place that is far off from you, and you stand there as a father, you stand there as a mother as that U-Haul drives off and you have tears coming down your eyes because it's as though a part of your heart has left. In fact, my wife found a quote one time that says, when you have children, you decide to live with your heart on the outside. Because they are our heart, they are our soul. And when you take them to college and you walk off and you leave them at college, you put them in that U-Haul and they drive off. It's like a part of your soul has been ripped out. But that's what we've raised them for, and we are releasing them to their own responsibility. That's what we talked about last night. We're releasing them to their own responsibility. But I'm going to tell you, that's done intentionally. That's not done accidentally. That's done with great intent. Good homes don't just happen. Good homes happen by intent. Let me ask you this question. That is, what do you want for your children? Do you want just a good education for your children? Do you want your children just to be athletic, to be popular? Solomon would say, the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. We need to instill in our children the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. We need to instill within them that first of all, before education, before popularity, before athletics, comes the fear of the Lord that is a byproduct of the knowledge that they have. But that happens because we have intentionally done that. It's not going to happen just accidentally. It's not going to happen by osmosis and just fall out of the air. It's going to happen because we have intentionally and with great purpose determined that's what we're going to do with our children. And then I think we need to develop priorities. And this is what I mean by that. I don't mean the priorities we've talked about in the past. What I mean by that is to demonstrate this priority. Because when children come in the home and they are newborn and they're in their toddler years and they demand all the attention in the world, it's easy for the child to begin to think that they are the center of the home. We did touch on that. But what is necessary in the home is for the child to see that the child does not usurp the place of the mother and the father. That the father is still the father, the mother is still the mother, but the husband is still the husband, and the wife is still the wife. When we were at home, we never back-talked Dad. I never remember a single time in my life, and I'm not stretching that I remember back-talking my dad. But when Dad would leave for a meeting, we would back-talk Mom. But we also understood one thing in the home. That she didn't belong to us, she belonged to him, and he was the queen of the house. And what we as fathers need to help our children understand, and our sons understand, when he gets to a point that he gets past her and he withstands her, is that you are the father that he's going to have to get by you because that's your wife, not his. She belongs to me. She is mine, not yours. And you understand the place that you have in this home. Yes, we're glad to have you in this home. We want you in this home. But you understand that she's my wife and I will protect my wife. And that we're going to spend the time being husband and wife together. And that is so important in the child-rearing process. I know it's so hard for sometimes mothers and fathers just to take an evening to go out by their own, to leave those children with a babysitter or a grandparent. Trust me, the grandparents will love it. If you have them ready built in here, just take advantage. They'll love it. Take that moment in which you have just to sit quietly across the table and be husband and wife. They need to understand that priority in the home. They don't take the place of a husband or wife. And then finally, I'd like to suggest to you, we need to set before them the proper integrity. And this is what I mean by that. They need to see Christ living in us. They need to see Christ living as the center of our lives. Not that we talk about it, but that He is in act and in fact and reality the center of our lives. And we honor that with integrity. And they see our integrity because we keep the commitment that we're teaching them to honor God. A few weeks ago, I received a card in the mail, and I hope that what I'm fixing to do does not come off presumptuous at all. I hope it illustrates what I've been talking about. And I hope it doesn't come across as self-aggrandizement, because that's not my purpose. About a month ago, I received a card in the mail from my oldest grandson, who's 17 years old. And in his Bible class, they were studying 2 Timothy. And the teacher was teaching them that this was Paul's last letter to Timothy. And he was telling Timothy some things that he wanted Timothy to know as his father in the faith, leaving this letter for him. My grandson sent me this card in the mail and said, "Granddad, we're studying our class, Paul's last letter and Paul's last words to Timothy. I've always looked up and admired you and your love for the Lord and a great example of a Christian. Can you please give me some things to think about to be successful as a Christian?" Now just pause there. How do you think I reacted to that? Do you think I was dry-eyed when I got done with that? I got to tell you, I was overwhelmed by it. I showed it to his Nana, and she couldn't believe it. And so, in response, this is what I wrote Kaysen. "First, let me tell you, I'm so proud of you, and I'm so thankful that I have you. There's a proverb that says, 'Children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of the children is their father.' Well, all eight of you are my crown. I do not have words to adequately tell you how much I love you and how much I live for you all every day. You honor me by asking me for some helpful hints to live as a Christian. First, while it may sound really simple, the challenge is in the details. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, strength, and mind. Again, we quote that often, but in reality, it is so foundational to our lives. If when we do something, we have this attitude or think about this before we respond to someone, it will help us answer the question, 'Does this make me like God? Because I love Him, I want to be like Him in every area of my life. What if a husband and wife ask, 'Am I really loving God with all my heart if I cheat on my mate?' What if a young person would ask, 'Am I really loving God if I get involved in some kind of immorality, drugs, alcohol, or sex? Am I really loving God when I'm being disrespectful to my parents?' It sounds so simple, but it's challenging to live up to. Second, I will tell you that it's urgent that every day you and I press toward the mark. The mark is to be like the Father, to be transformed into the image of His Son, and never be satisfied until we awaken His image. Really, when I learned this in my early 30s, it changed my life. I filter everything I do and say, every attitude I have, through this concept. For example, when I'm mistreated by others, how do I respond? Do I respond with hate and ill will? No, I am to speak well of them, do good, and pray for them. I ask, how would I want to be treated if it were me? The golden rule. That makes me like God. Also, when I love your Nana, I ask myself, am I loving her like Christ loved the church? That makes me like Him. When I do something for you or one of the other grandkids, I ask myself, where is there like Christ? What is there like Christ I want to show them? I want you to see Christ in me. I want you to see His attitude, His disposition, His character, His words in me. I want to show you the Father. I don't lie, cheat, or steal because I fear getting caught. I don't engage in works of the flesh because I might go to hell. My motivation is I want to do all those things that please the Father. None of those things make me like the Father. I try to demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit because that makes me like Him. I try to love and stand up for what is right. And stand against what is wrong because that makes me like Him. I'm striving to the mark. I know I will never attain it, but I'm pressing for it. When you speak at my funeral, I want you to be able to say, Granddad showed me the Father. I want to be like Him. Third, I would say we reign with Christ. He enables us to be victorious. Do not live defeated. Live as a conqueror. Do not let life under the sun control your attitude or cause you to become bitter and filled with hate. Let the love of God be in your heart. Be filled with the fullness of God. Believe and accept that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all we ask or think. Satan wants us to cause us to live with a defeated attitude. God wants to create in us the spirit of conquerors. Do not become discouraged and show discouragement and allow discouragement to defeat you. In life, there'll be disappointment. I'm often disappointed in myself, but I learned just a few years ago, and I pause. And it was just a couple of years ago. To live as a victor because of what Christ has done for me. He did not die for me to be defeated. He died so I could win and live victorious. And live as one who reigns with Him and live as a conqueror. Case, and I've certainly done this, and I see other Christians do this far too often. We let this life dictate our attitude and how we view others in God. No, I will not let Satan fill my mind with that. I belong to God, and I'm a conqueror because of what He's provided for me. Case, and at times I've not been treated well by my brethren. I've learned I cannot control what they do to me, but I can control how I respond to them. Also, I can choose the attitude I have toward myself. Fourth and finally, the best thing I've ever done in this life is when I found your Nana. Who you choose to marry and make your life's companion will make all the difference in the world. She has made me who I am. She is the breath I breathe. She is my heartbeat. She is the greatest example in my life of one who lives what I've just shared with you. I would say your success as a Christian will be largely determined by who you marry. Find one like your Nana. God blessed me richly when He brought her to me. I love you, bud. I'm so proud of you. I hope this helps you. I was talking to his daddy a few days ago. And I said, are you aware of what Kaysen did? He said, no. I said, you don't know that he sent me this note? He said, no. I said, well, I'll run it off in PDF and I'll send it to you. I'm flawed. But I hope what he says and what he sees is a commitment that was given to me by my dad. That was given to him by his granddad or by his dad. And that the generations will continue because we fundamentally have a commitment to God by which we've learned to pray for each other and by intent have developed a home that honors Him and let them go to develop their own faith. Realizing this is a safe haven if you need us. And as older children have your mother and father as wise advisors. But it begins fundamentally with this. A word that is used so infrequently today, and when it is spoken, it is used so flippantly. Commitment to God. That's what Hannah had. And that's why she said, if you give Him to me, I'll give Him back to you. I've done what I could do with my children as far as raising them. Now they stand before God on their own. But I'll stand before God for what I did. I want to encourage you, parents, this time in your life with your children, whatever stage you're at, drink deeply because you'll never have this time again. And you have this opportunity. This opportunity. To show them Christ living in you. And I hope one day you get the joy of getting a note in the mail to say, "Granddad, can you tell me some things that help me live successful as a Christian?" If there's something we can do this evening to help you make life, heart and life right with God in some way, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.